instructions meant that he was going to be stopped, as usual, from doing anything that might be fun. "Out by the barn. I was going to bury my truck, and it was there." "Well, I'll tell you what," Ian said. "This is your dad's, and it's a tool for cutting things, so it wouldn't be a very good toy." A huge sigh of exasperation from March. "Hang on, hang on. What I was about to say is that we can sharpen it together if you like." He dug around in his pocket for the sharpening stone. The scythes needed frequent sharpening, so the stone lived permanently in his pocket at the moment. "Can I do it myself?" March asked, stretching his T-shirt down to his knees. "Yes, I'll show you how, and then you can do it yourself. I'll just hold it, and you can do the rest. You see, the billhook has one flat side and one rounded side. Well, you don't sharpen the flat edge, you just smooth the stone over the rounded edge like this." So he showed March how to rub the stone over the bevel of the blade, and March had to go at sharpening the hook himself, and then, in the middle of the task, Julie burst in, highly excited, because there was a huge bird, a bald eagle as it turned out, sitting on the top branch of the white pine at the corner of the hay barn. March rushed off to see it, and Ian put the sharpening stone and the billhook down on the kitchen counter, thinking that they'd come back and finish the job in a minute, and followed them out. Then Laura came around the corner of the house with a laundry basket, and a minute later Jake appeared from the same direction. And then Arthur, presumably wakened by the excitement, came out as well, and they all stood around with their heads tipped back, gaping up at the eagle, who was looking down at them in utter disdain. How many stepping stones? Laura going out to collect the laundry, March finding a billhook where a billhook shouldn't have been, a bald eagle sitting in a pine tree, the billhook and sharpening stone on the kitchen counter. Such small, unimportant events. After a while, the eagle flew off, and Laura told Julie and March she wanted them to come in and wash because they were going to play with friends straight away. Arthur said, "Might as well get back to it," and he and Ian set off down the track to the fields. They were starting on a new field, and it was Ian's job to scythe the edges so that Arthur and the horses could get the binder around. It wasn't until he picked up the scythe that he remembered he'd left the sharpening stone on the kitchen counter. Arthur didn't have one with him, so there was nothing for it but to go back to the house and get it. That was the final stepping stone. They were in the kitchen. Laura had her back to the wall, and Jake was standing directly in front of her, very close. He had one arm against the wall beside her, and with the other hand he was lifting her chin. She had her arms up, hands flat against his chest, as if she were going to push him away. But she wasn't pushing him away. That was what Ian noticed. That, and the look of horror on her face when she saw him in the doorway. If she'd been trying to get away, she would have looked relieved when he walked in, not horrified, so Ian reasoned, if he reasoned at all. Jake had his back to him, and Ian didn't wait to see his reaction. He turned around and walked out. He went directly back to the field where he'd left Arthur. He didn't debate what he should do, the rights and wrongs, the possible consequences. He was filled with an intent so furious, so ungovernable, that it left no room for thought. When he reached the field, he walked straight across it, straight through the tall, uncut grain, trampling it, sweeping it aside with his hands. Arthur brought the horses to a stop when he saw him coming, and then came to meet him, looking puzzled. When he was still a few feet away, Ian said flatly, "You'd better go back to the house."
"Something the matter?" Arthur said.
"Yes, your wife and Jake." For a second or two, Arthur stared at him, and then Ian saw understanding hit him. It was as if it hit him literally. Arthur almost staggered, then he pushed past Ian and started walking fast back to the house. Ian followed him. He left the horses standing in the middle of the field.
He followed Arthur, still not thinking, still focused solely on the image in his brain, Laura and Jake. He felt breathless, with a kind of excitement, a violent excitement made up in equal parts of rage and retribution. He was almost dizzy with it. He saw Arthur reach the steps to the kitchen and fling open the screen door and go inside. He knew that something was going to happen, that there were going to be consequences. He was glad. There should be consequences. The worse, the better. When he entered the kitchen, Arthur was just disappearing up the stairs. Laura was standing at the foot of the stairs, her hand on the banister, looking up. Jake must be up there, packing, probably, packing in a hurry, thinking that he would get away. Ian heard Arthur's footsteps crossing the landing, and then Jake's voice, light, falsely cheerful. There was a scuffling sound, and Jake said, almost laughing, "Hey, Art, hey, calm down, what's the matter?" Laura looked at Ian, and he saw she was shaking. She said in a whisper, "Ian, what have you done?" Ian stared at her, his mouth open, speechless with disgust. When he could find words, he said, "What have I done? What have I done? What have you done?" "Yes," she said. "Yes, but oh, Ian." Upstairs, Jake was talking fast, still sounding amused. But then there was more scuffling, crossing the landing, and they heard him say, "Jesus, Art, Jesus, take it easy." And then he came hurtling down the stairs, Arthur right behind him. At the foot of the stairs, Jake fell, and before he could get to his feet, Arthur reached down and grabbed him and hauled him upright. Jake tried to brush him off. He said, "Okay, okay," still trying to make light of it, trying to sound amused. He looked across at Ian and gave an embarrassed laugh, as if in apology for the unseemly behavior of his brother, but Ian saw that he was scared, which was good. Laura looked terrified. She'd backed away from the stairs and was standing in the middle of the room with her hands pressed against her face, and that was good, too. It wasn't until he saw Arthur's face that Ian began to feel uneasy. Arthur hadn't said a word, but there was something in his eyes that Ian hadn't seen before in anyone, far less in Arthur. It was the look of someone who had reached the limit, the end of the line, as if he were teetering right on the edge of a cliff within himself, and if he went over, there would be no telling what came next. He propelled Jake across the kitchen toward the door, and when they were still a few feet away, he gave Jake a shove, and Jake cannoned into the screen door so hard that it slammed open right back against the outside wall, and he flew out into the yard. Laura gave a cry and ran to the door, and Ian came after her. They saw Jake scramble to get up, and Arthur reach down and grab him by the back of his shirt and stand him on his feet and start propelling him toward his car. Jake was saying, "Okay, Art, okay, it's okay." But his voice was breathless. There was no pretense of amusement any more. Laura ran after them. Ian followed hesitantly, apprehensive now, but not yet scared, or not yet admitting that he was scared. He approved of what was happening. It was more serious, more violent than he had expected, but that was okay. Arthur and Jake had almost reached the car, and Arthur, pushing Jake toward it, spoke for the first time. He didn't shout, and his back was to Ian, but there was such force behind the words that Ian heard him clearly. He said, "Go. Go now." Maybe Jake was emboldened by the fact that Arthur had spoken. Maybe he thought he could reason with him now, that they could have a civilized discussion, which he, of course, would win. Arthur had let go of him, expecting him to get into the car and go now, this minute, but Jake turned to face him, his back to the car, and smiled and said soothingly, as if to an overexcited child, "Okay, okay, Art, I'll go right now. But my stuff is still up in the bedroom, just let me get my things, okay?" He shouldn't have done that. He should have got into the car and gone. Instead, he gave a little laugh, as if it had all been just a joke between them, and now it was okay, it was over, it was fine. He said, You're kind of overreacting, brother. Was it the laugh that did it? Or the patronizing tone? Arthur reached out and took hold of the front of Jake's shirt with both hands and lifted him into the air, right up into the air, and then slammed him against the car, slammed him so hard the car rocked with it.
"Go now," he said.
Ian, scared now, all right, seriously scared, saw the color drain from Jake's face from the force of it. Laura cried out and ran toward them and grabbed Arthur's arm, but it was clear that Arthur didn't even know she was there. He lifted Jake and slammed him against the car again.
"Go now," he said again, and lifted him once more. "Go now."
It was the thud of Jake's body against the metal of the car that was so terrifying. Running toward them, appalled, Ian saw that the force of the blows would kill him. Maybe that wasn't Arthur's intention. Maybe he just wanted Jake to go, wanted it so badly that there were no words to describe it, and so, in the absence of words, he was urging Jake on his way. Maybe that was all he thought he was doing, but he was going to kill him, nonetheless. Ian reached them and grabbed Arthur's arm, yelling at him to stop, but Arthur pushed him away. Ian staggered, regained his balance, and flung himself at Arthur again, wrapped his arms around his neck this time, and heaved backward. Arthur lost his balance and toppled over, and they both ended up on the ground. But in falling, Arthur did let go of Jake, and Ian, fighting to keep his arms locked around his neck, managed to yell, "Get into the car!" Out of the corner of his eye, he saw a figure running toward them. Carter still too far away to help, but coming fast. He saw Laura help Jake into the car and slam the door behind him, but he couldn't hold Arthur any longer, and as the engine roared into life, Arthur broke free. From where he lay on the ground, what happened next seemed to Ian to take so long that at any stage he should have been able to reach out and stop it. Jake, finally, inside the car, his face stiff with shock. Arthur scrambling to his feet and lunging for the car, one hand stretched out to grab the handle. Carter racing toward them, Laura reaching for Arthur, trying to block his path. And then the car, lurching as Jake slammed it into reverse, taking off from a standing start and roaring backward in a great plume of dust and gravel, traveling so fast that Carter had no chance whatsoever. His face, as it hit him, frozen in astonishment, his body pitching forward, head hitting the rear window with such force that his legs were flung up and over, straight up and over, so that his body somersaulted right over the top of the car, and then slowly and finally down, and after that, stillness, silence. Strange the way the mind works. The way it protects itself from things it cannot face. Grief, for instance, or regret. Guilt. It finds something else, anything, to draw between it and what cannot be looked at. What troubled Ian most in the days following the accident was that he couldn't remember whether or not Carter had been with the rest of them earlier that afternoon when they'd gone out to look at the eagle. He would call up the scene in his memory again and again, trying to recall where they'd all stood, where within the little cluster of them Carter might have been. The others he could see quite clearly. He himself had stood directly behind March, because the little boy was craning his head back so far he was in danger of falling over backward. Laura was to his left, with Julie beside her. Jake was a few feet behind them. Arthur was beside the water trough, but he could never quite see Carter. He worried about it constantly. He wanted to be able to see him, there, with the rest of his family, head tipped back, looking up in awe at the magnificent bird. Epilogue. It was 5 in the morning when the phone on the bedside table rang. When he answered it and heard her voice, for a moment he was back at the farm, watching the car roar backward, the cloud of dust fly up. But then she said, "I'm sorry to call you at this hour, Ian, but it's Arthur." And he was back in the present again. "I'll be there in 10 minutes, he said. He switched on the light and swung his legs out of bed, feeling shaky and slightly nauseous from the vividness of the memory. It was like malaria, he thought, like a virus that lingers in the body and returns to haunt you. "Who is it?" his wife said, her voice muffled by bedclothes. "Arthur Dunn." He reached out and rested his hand on her hip, rocked her gently. "Go back to sleep." She rolled over and looked at him, her eyes screwed up against the light, but then she nodded and turned over and drew the covers up around her. She did her fair share of night visits. He drove to the farm with the windows down to clear his head. Dawn was just breaking, a pale slit of light dissecting the darkness. When he turned into the farmyard, he saw that the lights were on in the kitchen and in the bedroom upstairs. Laura was waiting for him at the kitchen door. She was wearing a dressing gown and her hair was loose. She must have got up in a hurry, alarmed and frightened, and silhouetted against the light, she could have been a girl again, younger than he had ever known her. As she opened the door for him, she said anxiously, "I'm not sure I should have called you, Ian. He seems better. I think he's asleep." "Don't worry," Ian said. "I'd rather you call." 6 months previously, just before his 59th birthday, Arthur had had a heart attack, and then a month later another one. He refused to go into the hospital, so there was very little Ian could do for him, but he visited him every day, twice a day in the past few weeks, to ensure that he was comfortable. Whenever he had time, he sat with him, mostly in silence, of course, Arthur being Arthur, though occasionally Ian would pass on some bit of local gossip or ask how things were going on the farm. March was running the farm now. He and his wife had built a house a couple of 100 yards down the road. They had just had their first child, a son, delivered by Ian's wife. He went upstairs on his own. Arthur was asleep. Laura had been right about that, but his breathing was noticeably worse than it had been the previous day. Ian stood looking down at him, his fingers on the faint, irregular pulse, feeling the heavy ache of loss. His own father had died 2 years ago, and the weight of that was still with him. Laura was at the foot of the stairs when he came down. She asked how Arthur was, and then said, not quite looking at him, "I wondered if you would have time for a cup of tea, Ian. I know you must want to get back." "Of course," he said. She must know that the end was very near for Arthur, and he supposed she had questions. And that was so, at first. When she had poured the tea, she sat down opposite him at the table he had once known so well, and asked all the painful and inevitable questions that attend the ending of life. How long did Arthur have left? Would he suffer at the end? Was there any way of easing his passing? Questions that Ian had been asked so many times in the course of his professional life that giving the answers should have become easier. But it was never easy, and particularly not today. Laura was struggling with tears, and Ian was not far off himself. When she had run out of questions, they both sat for a minute or two, and then Laura said, "You've been a good friend to him, Ian." He looked at her uncertainly. In the years since Carter's death, they had never spoken of what had happened. In fact, they had scarcely spoken at all. Where do you start when something like that lies between you? What words, what topics of conversation do you use? After the funeral, he had written to her, apologizing for what he had done, for his criminally stupid action in telling Arthur what he had seen, an action that over the years had caused him 1,000 sleepless nights. He'd been desperate to know how much she blamed him. She hadn't replied, and somehow over time his need to know had become a need not to know. Given the choice now, he would have avoided the subject forever. But it seemed he no longer had the choice. "I've always admired him," he said. If they were going to talk about it, he would be as honest as he could. She nodded. "Yes, I know." "And you," Ian said, "I admired you very much." "Not always," she said, looking at him. Despite her directness, she looked very fragile in the early morning light, bruised almost as if her emotions lay just beneath the surface of her skin. He hesitated. "No, not always, but I was just a kid, Laura. I thought in black and white back then." Black and white. For a long time after Carter's death, it had been more like black and red, the colors of rage and loathing, of her and of himself. Rage, loathing, and overwhelming guilt. He had left for Toronto at the end of that summer and had spent the first 2 years of his medical degree in a haze of exhaustion and despair. During the day, he was able to distract himself with his studies, but at night, Carter would come to him. Ian would see him sitting at the dining table, questioning Jake about the car, his eyes alight, his whole body animated with interest and enthusiasm. Or he would see him at the moment the car hit him, or on the ground, staring sightless at the sky. In the darkness of those nights, it seemed to Ian that he was guilty not just of an act of jealous rage, but of murder. Sleep became a place to avoid at all costs, and at the end of his second year at medical school, he had a nervous breakdown. Even with his father's help, the climb back to health took a long time, and it was more than a year before he was well enough to return to Toronto and continue his degree. During all the years of his training, he was sure that he would never return to Struan, but in the end, it pulled him back. His wife, Helen, whom he'd met during his third year in Toronto, was a city girl, but her family had a summer cottage on Lake Nipissing, and she loved the north. She was a general practitioner, too. Until his father's death, there were three Dr. Christoffersons in the town. There being three doctors meant, of course, that there was no need for him to see the Duns professionally, so apart from meeting briefly at church or in town, Ian was able to avoid them and to avoid what lay between them. And so it went on, and time passed, and although the ghost hadn't been laid, it tormented him less often. And then, 6 months ago, at 8 o'clock on a bright Monday morning, Laura phoned the doctor's office to say that Arthur was lying on the ground and couldn't breathe, and it was Ian she asked for. He didn't know why, perhaps it was Arthur's wish, but whatever the reason, he was grateful to her now because it had forced him, finally, to re-establish his relationship with Arthur and gave him the opportunity in some small way to make amends. Still, though, when he looked at Laura, what he saw was the events of that day, and he knew that for her it was the same. They couldn't get around it. If he stayed to chat with Arthur, she would bring tea up to them, but she never stayed herself. Before he left, Ian would step into the kitchen to tell her how Arthur was doing, and then he would go. That was the extent of their communication up until now. Laura was looking away across the kitchen, focusing on nothing. He studied her, looked at her properly for the first time in many years. She was still beautiful in his opinion, but her face was thin and lined, and her hair had faded to an uncertain gray. Perhaps she had never been quite as beautiful as he imagined. He had laid his absurd image of womanhood upon her and required her to live up to it, and when she failed, how devastating his retribution had been. She turned and looked at him, and he was afraid she had felt his gaze and guessed his thoughts, but she said, "There is something I want to say, Ian." He nodded and braced himself for what might come. She said, "I want you to know now, while Arthur is still here, that I love him, and that I loved him then." He was startled. It wasn't what he had expected her to say. He had expected her to tell him how much she still held him to blame. She went on, her voice unsteady but determined. You said yourself that you thought in black and white back then. Young people do. So probably you would have assumed that I didn't love him, that I couldn't have.
He remembered Jake's hand lifting her chin, her hands on his chest. Yes, he had assumed she did not love Arthur.
After the funeral, she said, when Jake was finally leaving, Arthur asked me if I wanted to go with him. I said no. He said, was I sure?
Her face suddenly flushed.
That question, Ian, that question, was I sure? Next to Carter's death, that question has been the hardest thing I've had to live with, the fact that he had to ask it.
Ian saw the scene so clearly he might as well have been there. Arthur, standing in front of her, his hands hanging empty at his sides, desperate to be sure of her, preferring her to go rather than stay and be unsure, unable to endure the thought of any more doubt, any more deceit.
Ian nodded. He had a question, too, one that he could never ask, a question that next to Carter's death was the hardest thing he had had to live with. It was this. Had she been sleeping with Jake that summer? Because if she had not, if the scene he had walked in on was all that had taken place between them, then how much greater was his guilt? He remembered Jake as he had been at the inquest, his face ashen, looking straight in front of him, meeting no one's eyes. It was when he saw the state Jake was in that it came to him in a sudden, shocked moment of clarity that Carter was Jake's son. The verdict had been accidental death. But that had been no comfort at all. He turned his mind back to what Laura had said.
What did you say to him?
I told him I was sure, Laura said, her face still flushed with the pain of remembering. I said I wanted to stay with him. I told him that I did not love Jake. I loved him. It was true. It had been true for years. I knew what sort of man Jake was. How could I not know? And I knew Arthur was worth 10 of him. I think I'd always known that.
She lifted her hands, fingers spread as if she were trying to hold something or understand something.
I don't know how to explain it, Ian. There was something about Jake, excitement, I suppose. I remember the first time he spoke to me, the feeling that he had singled me, out of all the world. I thought he was the most exciting, fascinating person I'd ever met. I was very young, and of course I fell in love with him, and didn't see how little else there was.
She stopped for a moment and looked at her hands. Then she looked back at Ian and said,
"The incredible thing is, Ian, when he came back all those years later, he still had it, whatever it was, that spark. I didn't love him. In fact, I almost hated him by then, and I knew exactly what he was, and yet still he had it."
Listening to her, seeing her distress, her urgent need to explain, Ian suddenly found himself thinking of his mother. He wondered if she had ever regretted what she had done. Over the years, he had come to understand her a little better, but he had been unable to forgive. He feared it meant that he had an unforgiving soul.
"I wish," Laura said, her voice unsteady again, "I wish I knew that he believed me."
"Arthur?"
"Yes. I wish I knew for certain that he believed me when I said that I loved him, and that he still believes me. I can't stop thinking about it. I hope he does. I think he came to over the years. I've told him so many times. But after all that happened, maybe he doesn't. It worries me so much now when he's close to the end."
"He does," Ian said. Here at least was one question he knew the answer to. "He believes you." She gave him a strained smile.
"That's very kind of you, Ian, but you don't need to say that. I wasn't... You don't need to say anything." "It's true," he said. Her smile made him feel 16 years old again, and foolish. There was silence. She studied his face. "It's true, Laura. I know. Because, in spite of everything, that is not an unhappy man up there. I've spent enough time with him lately to know." She was searching his face. "Are you sure?" she said at last. "Yes," he said. "I'm sure."
He went up to see Arthur again before he left, suspecting that it would be the last time. He thought at first he was still asleep, but he opened his eyes as Ian came in. "Hi," Ian said. "How are you feeling?" "Okay." A trace of the old shy smile. He was a big man still, not reduced by his illness, a big, powerful man with a heart that was on its way out. From long habit, Ian touched his fingers to his pulse, felt the faint, uncertain heartbeat weaker now than even an hour ago. He sat down in the chair by the bed, turning it slightly so that it faced Arthur more directly, and as he did so, suddenly he saw the two of them sitting on burlap bags at the side of a field, scalding themselves on hot tea, the horses beside them cropping the grass. The image was astonishingly clear and strong. It made him wonder if maybe, given time, an image like that might come into his dreams instead of, or at least alongside, the ones of Carter, so that he could look back without such pain on the time he had spent on the farm, set the peacefulness of those days against the tragedy that brought them to an end. They sat in silence, comfortable apart from Arthur's labored breathing. Once, looking out the window, Arthur said, "You reckon it's going to rain?" And Ian turned and looked and said, "It could, all right. Did March get the oats in?"
"Yeah."
"That's okay, then."
Arthur nodded, and they settled back. Arthur thinking about the harvest Ian guessed, and he himself thinking that he was lucky, unimaginably lucky, to have had this time with him. Finally he said, "I should go." He badly wanted to stay, but the morning was progressing and he had other calls to make. He got to his feet, resisting the impulse to check Arthur's pulse yet again. He knew what it would tell him. "Is there anything I can get you?" he said, fighting hard to keep his voice light. Arthur shook his head. "I'm okay, thanks."
"I'll see you later, then."
"Yeah." The smile once more.
"And Ian, thanks for coming."
"Not just now. All those times. Back then." By the time he had finished his calls and got home, it was late morning. He and Helen divided the office hours between them, and it was her morning for the baby clinic, but she must have seen the car pull in because she stepped out into the hall to see him. It was a weekday, so their daughters were at school. "How is Arthur?" she asked.
"Pretty bad."
"I'm sorry." She studied his face. He smiled at her, and she said, "It's quiet this morning. Do you want to go out for a while?"
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I am, really." "I will, then. Ring the dock bell if you need me, okay?"
"Or if Laura phones?"
"I will." He went down to the dock and slid the canoe into the water. It was full daylight now, but quiet and still. He paddled slowly around to Hopeless. The Queen Mary was there as usual. Pete bent over his jig like a patient vulture.
"How's it going?" Ian said.
There was a fair-sized pike sloshing around in the bottom of the boat, teeth grinning wickedly.
"So-so," Pete said.
"Any sign of him?"
He tied the canoe to the rowboat and climbed in.
"Nope. But he's down there, man. He's down there."
The End. You've been listening to The Other Side of the Bridge by Mary Lawson, narrated by Paul Hecht and directed by Jeff Barron. And thank you for listening to Clipper Audiobooks.
Clipper Audio presents The Author Talks. Maggie Mash in conversation with Mary Lawson.
Mary Lawson is a Canadian writer living in England. Her first book, Crow Lake, was a prize-winning international bestseller, and her second and most recent, The Other Side of the Bridge, was longlisted for last year's Man Booker Prize and was also a Richard and Judy Summer Read selection. Well, Mary's with me here in the Clipper Audio Studios in London at the moment, so welcome, Mary.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Now, I hope you don't mind my saying, but you have been described as a late bloomer. I mean, why didn't you start writing before?
I'm famous for being old. That is true. There are lots of reasons why I didn't start writing before. The most important one, though, is that I really didn't know what I wanted to say. But in fact, as with all books that are suddenly bestsellers and the author's never been heard of, I started writing 20 years ago. I just didn't have any success before. Or a very small degree of success. I was writing short stories for magazines, and they did okay, but it wasn't really my form. I knew I wasn't particularly good at that. I wanted a chance to develop a character and relationships over time, and you can't do that in a short story, or at least I can't. So I did finally write a novel, and it took me 5 years, and at the end of that time, it wasn't any good. So I went back to short stories for a bit and then wrote one set in Canada, which was very successful. And somebody said to me, you should be writing about Canada and you should try a novel. So I wrote Crow Lake.
And how did you start with Crow Lake?
What was the initial idea?
What was the initial idea and inspiration for it?
I was yelling at my kids. It was exam time and I was shouting, turn off the television and go and do your homework. And I got a sort of echo inside my head of my mother doing the same to me, to all of us, in fact. And there was a story she used to tell us ad nauseam about her grandmother, my great-grandmother, who grew up and lived all her life on a subsistence farm out on the Gaspé Peninsula in eastern Canada. And never had a chance to go to school and was desperate for a chance to read and to learn and fastened a book rest to her spinning wheel. And I suddenly thought, that's quite an interesting story there, because she did get all of her kids off the farm. She was just desperate to get them educated and out of poverty. I mean, Canada's an immigrant country. And in immigrant countries, the key to escaping from poverty is education, and she was determined her kids would get it. So she got them all off the farm, and that, you know, that's kind of family lore, and my mother went on and on about it. But I thought, what if you had a family with that same tremendous drive and ethic, and there is sacrifice over several generations to get one really brilliant child to the point where he might go to university. And I thought, if I just tell the story and he manages that, then that's not a story. He's got to blow it. What's going to happen if he blows that chance? So I decided to tell it from the viewpoint of an adoring little sister. I have two older brothers, so I knew how hero worship feels. So I had two characters, this little girl, Kate, and this brilliant older brother, Matt, who is the one who carries all the family dreams, and he blows it. And the story really, in a sense, is about what that does to Kate and how she perceives that in adult life. So it moves back and forth in time.
And it is about education, really, isn't it? And attitudes to education, because she is so, so disappointed.
Yes.
She's, by Matt.
That's right. She looks at him in later life and sees a failure. And he's not a failure. He made a mistake, but he has made a very good life for himself. And he is still the same fabulous brother, still just as brilliant, just as remarkable a man as he was a boy. But she doesn't see it when she looks at him. She sees a failure. And they were very, very close. So that is real true agony for Matt, for her brother.
Now, this is something that seems to interest you, family relationships, and particularly siblings. Why are you so interested in...
Well, they're so intense, the relationship between siblings, it seems to me. And you're trapped. I mean, if you make a friend at school, say, and it turns out you don't have much in common, then that friendship will just kind of fade away. But while you're growing up, you can't escape your siblings and your parents. And sometimes people who have very little in common have to share a bedroom, this sort of thing, for years and years and years. And I think there are very few people who are really genuinely indifferent to their families, to their brothers or sisters. They may not see much of them, but the odds are they still feel a bond, and it can be a good one or a bad one. It can be love or it can be hate, but it's unlikely to be neither, you know. So I think there's a lot that can be explored within the sibling relationship, and also the way parents treat different children of their own, you know. Two kids will grow up with the same parents, but will have entirely different experiences because the parents don't treat them quite the same. So both books do look at the relationship between the siblings and also the nature-nurture question about, are you born as you are, or is it your parents' fault if you turn out badly? That sort of thing. I do find it a very interesting subject.
It's interesting because they're very different in the two books, because in Crow Lake you've got this adoring relationship,
That's right.
Kate and Matt. And then, of course, in The Other Side of the Bridge, you've got this very difficult relationship between the two brothers.
That's right. Arthur and Jake, who might easily have come from different families. You can hardly believe that they have come from exactly the same family. But in fact, they are treated very differently by their parents. And also, they just don't have anything in common. And then there is this little question of jealousy. Jealousy plays a huge role in The Other Side of the Bridge. Not so much in Crow Lake. There isn't quite the friction between siblings, although the two brothers do have their moments, no doubt about that.
Yes, there is a bit of a fight between Luke and Matt, isn't
there?
There
is, based really on the fact that Matt, the brilliant one, does not believe that Luke, who is the one of whom nothing is expected, can really do what Luke has set out to do in that family. And his lack of faith in Matt, in Luke, is a real problem for him.
Now, is it true that you based Bo, the little sister, on your sister?
I did. And I want to stress that I do not base my characters, on real people. I would find that very limiting. You couldn't know another person well enough to write about them in the way I wish to write about people. You've got to create them from scratch. But when I wrote Crow Lake first, when I tried to turn it into a novel, I gave this initial relationship of a brother and sister another sibling, Luke, the older sibling, so that he would make great sacrifices so that the family could carry on as it was. But then I realized that I had a book about death and failure, and it was going to be a very gloomy read, and I was going to have to inject some light relief into it. So I thought, okay, I will bring in a very young child, a baby almost, and I will make her a complete nightmare to give everybody a really hard time. And I started to write it, and within, I don't know, a couple of paragraphs, I found myself thinking, this is Eleanor. I mean, my sister would be perfect in this role. She was a complete nightmare. She gave my mother so much trouble. So I phoned her, Eleanor lives in Toronto, and said, honey, do you mind if I use your infancy in a book? And she said, no, not at all, go ahead, because she was as confident as I was that it was never going to be published. So, however, She gets 10%, so she has nothing to complain about. She's quite happy with it, I think.
Did she enjoy the book?
She did. Well, she had to read it so often that I think the word enjoy probably isn't right. It took me 3 years to write the initial draft of Crow Lake, and I kept sending her new drafts and new drafts. And finally, I asked her, please, just to read it one more time. And she said, I want 20%. And I said, well, no, you can have 10. And then, of course, when it did sell, she phoned and said, you know, I was joking. And I said, no, I don't think so, because I have to use you. And when I sent it to her at the end of 3 years, she's not a writer, but she's very, very analytical, and also the only one in the family brave enough to tell me the truth. And she said, there's not enough to it. It's just a long, short story. You need something else. So it took me a further year to figure out what else, and another year after that to rewrite it. So that was 5 years in total. But then when I sent it back to her, she said, send it out.
It sounds as if she's a very, very good critic for you.
She is. She and my husband are both very good, actually. But he has to live with me, and, you know, he likes his dinner. So he's very inclined to think what I write is great, whereas she is much more critical at a safe distance of 3,000 miles.
So you said that it was a friend who actually said you should set it in Canada.
Yes.
How do you feel about that now? I mean, do you feel that you're going to continue writing about Canada? Is it a nostalgic thing for you?
I think it was the most incredible stroke of luck that she said that, because it was then that I started to really enjoy writing. And I think the reason for that is that, despite the fact that I've lived in England now for 39 years and left Canada when I was just 22, I know Canada on a different level. As soon as I started writing about the families and the community and the values and the rules that people live their lives by and so forth, I knew it was right. I knew I had it right. I couldn't do that if I wrote about England, because I did not spend my childhood here. I would have to base things much more in the present. I would have to write as an outsider, an immigrant to England. And I don't think that is my central interest. I prefer writing about childhood, if you like, or the experiences of...
And the importance of certain places, like the ponds, for example.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the landscape is incredibly important to me, and I think that's another reason why I've enjoyed writing these books so much, that when I'm writing them, I'm back in the landscape. And also, the little farming community that I grew up in was quite isolated, and it's a different way of life when you're in a small, remote community like that. And when I was thinking about the books, I realized that a sense of isolation would be important there too. I think everything is more intense if you don't have huge cities watering everything down. In little communities, everybody knows each other, and everybody knows each other's parents and grandparents, probably. And there are expectations, and there is lots of friction. I could never go back and live in a small community now. But people do look out for each other. They have to, because there's no one else to do it. So when I came to set the books, I thought, all right, I grew up in southern Ontario in a little farming community there, but no one is going to believe that it could be as remote as it actually was. So I think I'll move it further north into the landscape of what's known as the Canadian Shield, this enormous, beautiful area of rocks and trees and lakes, where my family's had a summer home for six generations now.
So it was an area you knew.
It's an area that I know very well, and that I absolutely love. And strangely, that not only myself, but my siblings think of as their real home. That's the family home up there. That's always been home. And it's a gorgeous landscape. So it's a nostalgic trip when I write about that area.
And it's nice when you came to write the second book, The Other Side of the Bridge, you used one of the characters from the first book, the doctor.
That was very self-indulgent and it got me into a lot of trouble. I really loved writing Crow Lake. I didn't want to leave it behind when it was finished. It was quite painful for me when it was finished. So I thought, I know, I will carry one of the characters over. And initially, actually, that character was Bo. And I tried to give her a little cameo role in The Other Side of the Bridge. But Bo is a powerful character, and there was no way that she was going to be happy with little cameo role. That every scene I put her in, she dominated. And I thought, no, I've done her story. I should put her aside and move on. So I took Dr. Christofferson because he's the only doctor for 100 miles, and he will know everybody, and therefore he will know the characters in both of the books. But unfortunately, what I didn't realize when I did that was because he was a middle-aged man in both books, and had to be for the purposes that I wanted him for, that tied the two books together in time. And therefore, all of the other characters had to fit in with the time that Dr. Christofferson was a middle-aged man. The central character in The Other Side of the Bridge had to be quite a bit younger than the doctor. And so I worked out, logically, that he had to be born about 1920, which was a pain because I was going to have to do some research, but I hoped not all that much.
You don't like doing research?
I hate doing research. It's partly laziness, I guess, but also because it takes away from the writing time, you know? What I like is telling the story. I like stories.
You're very much a storyteller. I mean, that's your style.
Yes.
Reading the books or listening to them, you know, you can hear the story as it goes through and all these little hints and signposts and if I'd known then.
Yes.
It's very much a storytelling style. Was that deliberate?
No. I didn't set out to write like that. The only thing that I did deliberately in the writing, which I did with Crow Lake and then again, with The Other Side of the Bridge, was keep it very pared down. Fancy, flowery, sophisticated writing would not have been appropriate for those stories. It was a very unsophisticated time and place. And therefore, I thought, cut the fancy writing. Just strike out as many
adjectives.
Stick to the
story.
Stick to the story. Make it simple, because that suits what's about to happen.
Now, who was your main character in The Other Side of the Bridge, the one that came to you first?
Arthur. He is the central character. And I absolutely loved him from the moment he occurred to me. I've no idea where he came from. I've never known anyone like him. I saw him first as a teenager, growing up on a farm. A big, heavy kid, not very swift. Not at all interested in school. It just wasn't him. He wanted to be a farmer like his dad. And as far as he was concerned, real work was working out on the farm. And I thought, you know, he's not the most exciting character in the world. So he's an unlikely choice for a hero. But I knew he was going to be the hero. I knew he had a story to tell. But I thought, he's going to need a real problem. The problem that Arthur deals with is going to have to be what makes you want to keep turning the pages. The problem will be the driver of the story. So what is it? And then I thought, okay, I'm going to give him a brother. Brothers are always problems. So I gave him Jake, who's 5 years younger and smart and handsome. And just about everything that Arthur isn't, but very, very jealous. I still didn't know exactly what the relationship between the brothers was going to be, but I started writing anyway. And in the prologue, I made them about, I think Arthur's 13 or 14, and Jake is about 8 or 9. and I had them play a game with knives that my brothers used to play when they were young. And by the time I finished the prologue, I think it's 3 or 4 pages long, I knew what was going to happen in the rest of the story. It just became perfectly evident what the friction between these two brothers was. And all I had to do was sit down and write the story.
So I was going to ask you that. You know, do you see the end of the story quite early on when you're writing?
I saw the end of The Other Side of the Bridge early on. I knew pretty much what was going to happen in that story. Although I had a lot of trouble with the other central character, who is Dr. Christofferson's son, Ian. I've known an awful lot of smart adolescent boys, having had 2 of my own, but I just could not get this kid to come clear in my mind, and I lost about a year trying to figure out who he was. I really had a problem with him. But the central story is Arthur's, and I did know just exactly what was going to happen. Right up until the final 3 or 4 pages, I didn't know what that was going to pan out as. I knew there was going to be a really serious incident in those final pages, but I didn't know what the outcome of it was going to be. I didn't know that right until I got to the end of the book. It suddenly became apparent. But with Crow Lake, I really did not know what the point of the short story was until I got to the end, and I sat there looking at it, thinking, well, what is it you've said here? And then suddenly I realized what it was that I was thinking, this business that we are so blinkered, so narrow in our definitions of success or failure and intelligent or unintelligent. I mean, I think the word failure should be deleted from the dictionary. I think the way we pressure our kids nowadays suggests that the only route to success, the only worthwhile thing to do, is to be academic, which is just a nonsense. There's no reason why we need that many academics. If kids are interested in it, then that's fabulous, that's great. But they have so many other skills, children do.
And it's nice in The Other Side of the Bridge because you have Ian's friend, Pete.
Yes.
Who is very bright and could go away to university.
Absolutely.
And he decides not to.
That's right. He's a very... I really like Pete. Next to Arthur, he's my favorite character in the book, I think. He's very cynical. He's growing up on an Indian reservation outside the little town. I went to school in a little community just when my parents were there. My brothers were there. It was just a one-room school. But we all went to it, including some of the Indian kids from the reservation. And the expectations of those kids back then, I'm talking, I was born in 1946, so that's the sort of era I'm talking about, were not great. Not very many of them would have even been encouraged to go on to university. Many of them, I'm sure, were capable of it, but that was not the expectation. So in The Other Side of the Bridge, it's a little bit later. It's 1957-58 by the time we're looking at Pete, the character of Pete. And he is being encouraged by his teachers to continue, and he is sitting his senior matriculation, and he definitely has the potential to go on to university. He's a very bright lad, but he's also very sorted. He knows what matters to him. He's far less romantic and idealistic than Ian, who is his closest friend. Ian really does see the world through dangerously rose-colored spectacles. Ian sees things in black and white, and Pete knows perfectly well that it's not as easy as that.
And also, Ian can't decide what he wants to do with his future, whereas, as you say, Pete is quite sorted. He knows.
Well, Ian is fighting fate, I think. This is another thing that I really enjoy tinkering with, the idea of do we have control of our destinies or not? Ian was born to be a doctor. He was absolutely cut out for it. He really
You can
was.
Tell when he's helping his father. He's a natural.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's a natural. He has exactly the right response when the chips are down. He knows what to do, what's important. But he just strongly resents the fact that everybody in this little town expects him to be their next doctor, because both his father and his grandfather were their doctors. So he is resisting this, left, right, and center. And I don't want to give too much away, but I think it's probably clear now.
Well, you can. You can, it's right.
He turns out to be a doctor. Pete always knew that Ian was going to do that. And just thinks, why are you trying to kid yourself? You were born for that job. You'll be a fantastic doctor. In an initial draft of the book, I had Ian say, look, man, I had Pete say to Ian, look, you're arrogant and you always think know what's best for people. You're cut out to be a doctor. So, but then I thought maybe that wasn't very polite, so I deleted it.
Now, you said that your main character was born in 1920, so that's Arthur.
Yes.
So this meant that you had to bring the war in.
That's right. I realized to my absolute horror that he was going to be 19 at the outbreak of the Second World War, which meant that I was going to have to deal with the subject of how the war affected the North. Now, that meant research in a big way, but not only that, I simply couldn't see how I was going to find it out, because the sort of thing I needed to know was social history. You do not find it in a textbook. And it wasn't as if I could even go into the libraries here and get old newspaper archives. England has English newspaper archives. It does not have Canadian. And I was wailing about this to one of my sons. He was off at university, saying, I honestly have no idea what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to rethink the book entirely. I'm completely ground to a halt. And the next day, I got an email from him saying, click on this website, Mum. You know how kids always know about computers and we never do. Anyway, I clicked on that website and it was something called the Paper of Record, which is the best research tool ever invented, I am sure. Because what it consists of, back then I think there were 144,000 newspaper articles from all over the place, including, unbelievably, from a little weekly paper called the Temiskaming Speaker in Canada. And Temiskaming is the area where I set the books. So there I had, at the click of a computer
key, stroke of luck.
Absolutely incredible gift of the front pages of that newspaper dating all the way back to 1905. It was just an amazing thing to be able to call those up and see what was happening in the North then. And what was happening was very much the same as happened over here and probably in every country that was involved in the war. All the young men from a community enlisted together. And they fought side by side. And if things went badly, they died together. And there were communities, I'm sure there were here as well, where they lost every one of their young men. A whole generation wiped out.
And certainly some families who lost all their sons.
Absolutely. That happens in the other side of the bridge. There's another thing that I discovered from the newspaper was that there were prisoner of war camps up in Canada. The UK sent us their prisoners of war. I had actually been aware that there was a prisoner of war camp near where our family home was up north, but I'd never really twigged what that was about. Large numbers of German boys were POWs in Canada.
So you were able to bring that into the
book? And I brought that into the book. And also the plight of German immigrant families to Canada. That was really tragic because, of course, they were desperate to prove their loyalty to their new country. And therefore, they sent their sons off to fight for Canada. Not, I might say, for England, but to fight for Canada. So these poor lads would be quite possibly fighting cousins, you know. Just a terrible, terrible state. Well, that's war, always, I'm sure. But it had a terrible effect on the North because, of course, if a little farming community loses all its sons, that's the end of it. You need those
boys. How do they operate?
That's right. You need those boys to work the land.
Now, do you think that things like... I know that you talk to reading groups quite a bit, book groups, and also your books are being made into audiobooks. Do you think things like this help to foster an interest in reading?
Oh, I think they're very important. I think the whole business of reading has been transformed, actually, by the growth of the book groups and also audio tapes, because it's not this, it's, I think it's kind of similar to going to a cinema on your own, as opposed to going with friends. If you look at a reading group, people really discuss the books that they read in reading groups. They really think about them. And I think that means that they want to read slightly more challenging books than they would otherwise. Not just a simple story, but something that they can all discuss. And I think the same with audiobooks. I think you've got people who are able to listen when they wouldn't, in fact, be able to sit and read. You see people listening to audiobooks on the train and this sort of thing. And it has widened the access, if you like, of books to a larger public. And I think there is more of an interest. I know so many people who belong to reading groups. I belong to one myself. I think they're a fantastic thing. And I do a lot of speaking to them because I find that the people in those groups are very thoughtful and will have read very carefully. And I find their questions really interesting and informed.
So what next? What's your next book? Is it going to be set in Northern Ontario again?
Yes, I think it is. I don't think I'm quite finished with the North as yet. I have a couple of characters in my head. I have no idea what their stories are. I don't know what happens to them. I don't know what the themes are. I don't know anything except that these are two pretty good characters and that I'm going to be interested to see what works out for them.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing what happens to them as well. Mary, thank you very much indeed.
It's been a real pleasure.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.